It is a center for higher learning.
It is a place with centuries of secrets in its shadowed halls.
This is where you have come to learn the mysteries of the cosmos.
Welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast.
They'll teach you things you can't unlearn.
Hello, and welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast, episode 170. This is the podcast dedicated to Call of Cthulhu and other horror and Lovecraft-related role-playing games. I'm Keeper John.
I'm Keeper Murph. In this episode, Jin Martin joins us to talk about Gatsby and the Great Race. Hello, Jin.
Hi there.
Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you.
Yeah. So before we talk to Jen, we are thrilled to announce that this episode is sponsored by Pelgrane Press, and they are gifting you, our student body, with a discount voucher code for a new book of monsters for your Trail of Cthulhu games. It's called Hideous Creatures, A Bestiary of the Cthulhu Mythos. It's by Kenneth Height and friends, so listen for that later in the show. But first, let's see what's happening in the Campus Crier.
Miskatonic University Campus Crier.
The Campus Crier is Miskatonic U's student paper. Here's where we go through mythos-related news and feedback to the podcast. This episode was recorded on March 28th, 2019. Chiasium has announced that Lynn Hardy will now serve as a permanent associate line editor for Call of Cthulhu. Congratulations,
that
Lynn.
That is fantastic news, and actually a lot of us didn't realize that she wasn't already full-time, but it's fantastic. I'm glad that she is.
That is awesome. So she and Mike be helming this into the future.
In other sadder news, Willem Hopfrog Pugmire, also known as W.H. Pugmire, celebrated author and creator of the Sequoia Valley and Weird Tales therein, has passed away. He died on March 26th after suffering a heart attack the week prior. Rest in peace, Willem.
Yeah, that's really sad.
That's very sad.
If you saw this, the internet is freaking out about a New Jersey high school that put on a play of Alien. Yep. And there are a couple of clips available. We have a link in the show notes for anybody who wants to see that. It looked amazing. Yep. And, from just the bit that I saw,
Ridley Scott actually came out today and said that he gave it the thumbs up. He said you should do Gladiator next, is what he told the high school.
That is awesome.
I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, I even saw a video online of Sigourney Weaver giving her praise. So
yeah,
that's
nuts, man. They did a fantastic job. According to the small press, the Sons of the Singularity, an official with the Chinese government, has ordered the entire print run of the Sassoon files to be destroyed. We mentioned the Kickstarter, the kickstarted Call of Cthulhu supplement that was set in the 20s Shanghai a few episodes back. And like a lot of publishers, they chose to print their work in China. In a video on YouTube, one of the creators named Jesse Kovner announced that their printer contacted the creators to say that there was a quote sensitive issue with the book's content, and government officials ordered all the copies destroyed by the next day. Jesse had initially said burned, but later corrected and that said that they had been pulped. The words burned and incinerated have been repeated all over the media coverage, despite the creator's correction that he made on Reddit. There's two separate issues going on here. One is the Chinese government's suppression of free expression, which has been worsening for more than a decade. It's extremely serious and has an astronomically larger effect on Chinese creators than those with expat privileges looking for a cheap printer. The government's crackdown on free expression just cannot be justified at all, right? And I don't want you to think that's what we're fixing to do. It's far from the first time that China has ever targeted a foreign creator for censorship, but likely reasons that were cited by Kovner himself include photos of Chinese historical figures and heroes, a historically accurate flag that is also the current flag of Taiwan, a depiction of soldiers of the Chinese People's Liberation Army fighting Cthulhu, a reference to time travel, reincarnation, Christian cultists, plagues that start in China. Kovner also called the local official who made the decision a quote dumbass. The other issue in here is the sensitive content itself. The Kickstarter page pitches the project explicitly from perspective of Victor Sassoon, a colleague of Henry Armitage, who in an era of vile racism and wrongs perpetuated by the British Empire, quote, fights to keep the empire safe while keeping Shanghai free from the mythos, much like a white foreign savior would. And then add this to a list of things like the corrupted Taoist ritual, making colonial Shanghai into a play space that's treacherous. It's just treacherous ground in general, particularly from the perspective of expats representing oppressors. There are things about this project that are just as problematic inside the country as they are outside, right? Full stop. What happened is horrible. It shouldn't have happened in the first place. But if you're going to send your material to go to China, this probably wouldn't have been the one I would have sent to China to be printed. You know what I mean? A campaign that's actually set in historical China and uses references left and right of historical China. And God only knows what the images are like. I mean, Call of Cthulhu scenarios are famously explicit in some of their images. So who knows what was in there that caused this guy to go off and order the whole thing pulped. But, you know, it is what it is at this stage.
Yeah, I assume that they'll just find another printer and send those files to a different printer.
That's what he said. They were trying to find a different printer out of China, somewhere else, just have it printed there. And that should be the end of the discussion, I think. And then they'll probably be printed and shipped overseas to here, to the continent at some point or another in the future.
So moving on from that, in Inner Darkness, the latest book by Golden Goblin Press, has successfully been funded. So congratulations to Oscar Rios and the entire team of creators, to include our own Chad Gerard.
Yes, congratulations, guys. Also, there is a new expansion for, get this, John, Munchkin Cthulhu, Munchkin Zombie, and Star Munchkin. All right, I found these on Twitter, on the Steve Jackson. They are up on Kickstarter right now. They have funded, and I'm a big fan of Munchkin Cthulhu. I've already backed it. You can get a single expansion for Munchkin Cthulhu for just $8, right? It's ridiculous. The price point is extremely low. It's very doable. You can get like all three of them for, I think, $20 or something. You can also get the add-ons to add the main game in there, so in case you don't already have it. It's great. And the cool thing I like about this one is all of the stretch goals that are set fairly low, and there's a fair amount of them, is just adding extra cards to each set. You know, so I think originally it was like a dozen cards in the set, and then each stretch goal is just adding more cards. So right now I think there's like, they've added 10 extra cards to each set because of the stretch goals. So it looks really cool. I can't wait to get them. It's a fun game. So yeah, thumbs up, Munchkin Cthulhu.
That's awesome.
Lovecraft created his shadowy conjurers because the stories of vampires, werewolves, and ghosts had become too familiar. Now his own monstrous races seem like comfortable story furniture too. In Hideous Creatures, a bestiary of the Cthulhu mythos for Trail of Cthulhu RPG, Pelgrane Press brings the horror back to Lovecraft's monsters, blurring boundaries and erasing certainties in the names of the uncanny. These creatures are adventures by themselves, leaving physical traces, occult clues, and madness in their eldritch wake. Hideous Creatures, a bestiary of the Cthulhu mythos, features 31 full creature write-ups, including 9 mythos monsters that have never taken stat block form in any game. Get 10% off the pre-order in the Pelgrane Press web store with the voucher code MISKUPOD2019. That's MISKUPOD2019. And as always, we have links in the show notes. Thanks a ton to Edwin for editing episode 170.
And thanks to Edwin. Yes, thank you, Edwin, for editing this episode.
The reference librarians locate various materials through their familiarity with the contents of the library.
Up next, we have another card catalog, the Steam Wagons. Steam Wagons were a widespread form of powered road traction for commercial haulage in the early part of the 20th century. Although they were largely a British phenomenon, with few manufacturers outside of Great Britain, these unique vehicles could be an excellent addition to a pulp Cthulhu game set in London.
Steam wagons, can I just say, or steam lorries, as they're also known, are freaking awesome.
Right? Yeah, and I could...
If you don't know what these are, people, these are essentially steam engines with wheels for roads. Yep.
And this people. Feels like it could be a great in a Pulp Cthulhu game where you maybe, you know, there's some Lovecraftian science, you know, under the hood, right? And
pulp written all over it, man. If you didn't know this existed, you would pitch it to someone and they say, okay, you're making that up.
Yep.
But yeah, this is a fantastic idea. I really like the idea of using steam wagons. It's nuts and great.
I love it too. And I want to say thanks again to Graham for sending this cool idea into the card catalog. And if you think you found something great for the card catalog, please email it to us at mup.feedback@gmail.com.
Welcome to the listening room. Rewind your reels and enjoy your selections in silence.
Next up, Mr. Tyler takes us back for part two of last episode's topic with a closer look at the black paintings of Francisco Goya.
All right, listen up. You're in detention today for falling asleep in school. I don't care if you long to escape into Twilight Realms, where magic molded all the little vivid fragments and prized associations of your mind into vistas of breathless expectancy and unquenchable delight. You still have to pay attention in Spanish class. Now, I don't want to be here any more than you do, so we're going to talk about whatever I want to talk about. Obviously, a purely auditory medium is the best way to discuss fine art, so in today's detention, we're going to continue our examination of Francisco Goya's black paintings, specifically the one member of this grotesque family which has creeped me out the most. Two old men eating soup. During my research for our last detention, I looked over the 14 paintings of this collection, and through that process, this painting continually caught my eye and held it. The image is of two figures, one reclining and one sitting up, painted in sickly greens, yellows, and browns with an endlessly deep black background behind them. The reclining figure is covered in a blanket. His face has a skeletal nose and his eye sockets are covered in shadow. He looks like he's already dead. The other figure is a lot more lively. A squat, decrepit, toothless old crone dipping a spoon into a bowl. The figure's eyes bulge excitedly at something just off the left side of the painting. And it's smiling. Does that really sound like two old men eating soup to you? Remember, Goya did not name these paintings. They were pretty much all named after his death by art historians needing a common language to talk about them. Is that reclining figure actually dead? Were they dead before or after the crone fed them soup? Is that actually soup in the bowl? I don't plan on answering any of these questions in this detention, but I think they're all worth asking. I really like that idea. An untitled painting that's been given a name which hides the true nature of its contents. What might you learn if you were able to discern what these paintings are really? Maybe they're a mythos tome. Each painting has its own spell that could be learned if you can just figure out what Goya meant. One of the other names in academia for two old men eating soup is witch's brew. Maybe you can figure out the ingredients if you just look at it hard enough. Or maybe the crone in the picture will be nice enough to come and tell you. One fact I find very strange is that Goya painted another painting a bit similar to this one in composition, but completely different in tone and style. During his illnesses, Goya was cared for by a Dr. Arrieta, and to thank him for his care, Goya painted a picture of Dr. Arrieta saving his life on his deathbed. While that painting has a much more heroic tone than Two Men Eating Soup, the composition and subject is very, very similar. And Goya made these paintings at the same time in his life, possibly in the same year. Is there a connection? Is Goya still jumping around somewhere in the moonlight thanks to Dr. Arrieta's medicine? That sinister, gummy, mawed, bulging-eyed old creature in the painting has absolutely become Keziah Mason in my head. Just imagine seeing that figure in the painting, and then seeing it in your dreams. Or maybe it's the opposite. Perhaps Goya saw this figure while lying in bed near death, and then he painted it. course, there is another person in this picture. What if the reclining figure isn't dead? It should be dead. It wants to be dead, but it's not dead. Perhaps it's some sort of mythos oracle kept alive by a witch, or a conduit to a greater unknown otherworldly power which is now leaking through. Or maybe instead of being fed in the picture, it's actually being harvested. Some essence, consciousness, or computational memory space is being taken from it with that spoon. And of course, this painting could symbolize almost any mythos truth. The blind cosmic hunger for devastation of Azathoth, the secret horrible feasts of the ghouls, the terrifying consumption of forbidden knowledge, ritualized blood sacrifices to Rantagoth, or even a long-lost secret of the Spanish court. And you can do this with any of the black paintings. These are the record of a disillusioned, scared artist screaming into the void. You just need to decide what screams back. Well, that's it for your detention. Stay out of trouble.
I love that. That was awesome. Yes.
Great.
You know, and something else I thought about is I've seen some videos online where art restorationists are able to clean up paintings.
Oh, yeah.
And it's amazing.
One of my favorite stuff to watch on YouTube.
Yeah, isn't it great? But what, you know, what if with these black paintings, what if that the black is actually, you know, it was added later because it's trying to obscure something, and a restorationist is able to remove just that layer of black, layer, and now there's something else there.
That'd be awesome. There's also there's another Goya that's just called Two Old Men that I find that's the worst one for me. And it's basically like this old man who looks like a shepherd. He's got a huge beard. He's got like a big hook crane, and he's got his hands resting on the cane in his hands. And he's just kind of sitting there, and over his shoulder is this, like, I don't know. It's called Two Old Men. It doesn't look like a man to me. It looks like a demon face, and it's got his mouth is open, like he's either going to eat his ear or he's talking into his ear. And you see one like really weird colored hand resting on the old man's shoulder. And that one is just, that one just gives me the willies personally.
That's awesome. But,
and now it looks like we have some feedback for the last episode.
Yeah, we got a letter from Echelon Mockingbird, and I think we're going to condense it for length, but cover some of the highlights. He came and said, what if the Secrets of Berlin title had been changed because the Thule Society pressured them to make it sound more like fiction because it was too close to the truth, and some of the major characters are still alive, and maybe they've already gotten to Larry, and they're on to you too, or to us, I assume he's meaning. Should we run screaming into the night? Maybe we should. So I thought that was kind of funny. He also talking about the what was the name of that thing? Chemistry Foundry?
Yep.
Yeah, Chemistry Foundry. We should get some of those and compile some of the best of those bits from the chemistry books, add some art, and then we could publish that as the Archimist Cookbook. That was a kind of cool idea.
I like that name, the Archimist Cookbook.
I do. I like that name. And then that episode, obviously, we were talking about villains and what makes a good villain. And he had really kind of a funny point. Consider Superman. When he goes to sleep at night, he wakes up in the morning, he'll get ready for work, eat breakfast, maybe play some video games. You know, he's living the life as Clark Kent, and he does all this while he can hear, with his super hearing, the screams of dying people, and he rationalizes his inaction because he just has to accept that he can't be everywhere at one time helping everyone. Now, does that make him simply a fact of being an alien? Is he inhuman? What is it to be human after all? Is that good or bad? So those are some interesting points he brought up. So thank you for the letter, Echelon Mockingbird.
And next we had another feedback email. This one was from Christine F. This one's not as, we've got some mea culpas, John. We've got to make some corrections, I think. She says, I have to say my jaw dropped during the Scum and Villainy episode, and not in a good way. For the love of the Orn Library, please don't encourage your listeners to portray disabled people specifically as villains. It's too much like how Hollywood movie casting has traditionally ignored minorities' existences unless directly called for in a script as gang members or villains. So that's the main way they showed up. Not cool. It adds to a dehumanizing, othering mindset. See the opening statistics from the CDR essay and the British Film Institute links, which are below for the real world effects. Please do include disabled NPCs in your world, but not only as villains or victims. Like racial minorities and women, these characters can help your game get more interesting if you include them like people beyond this one aspect, not as the handy now generic disabled stereotype. Side note, as a female player and keeper, I have a request to explicitly state, because I still see and read way too many of these in modules, please let the following female villainy tropes die in a fire. Femme fatale who lives for her power over men, man-haters, and the non-beautiful or spurned woman taking vengeance against those who ignored or mocked her. Also, please get more creative than the woman hunting for a man, pursuing her chosen love at all cost, or, quote, but she did it for her kids. It's time for some updated thinking. I really liked the butler example you worked through. Her motivations were completely unrelated to the stereotypes of her gender. It would be great if more folks would just take that approach. Go pods, Christine.
So thank you. Yeah.
Thank you very much. We've got the links that you provided as well in the show notes there. We just got this in today, the day we actually recorded this. And we've gone back and we've listened. And I have to admit, I think what she's referring to is when I go off on a rant about Don Carlos, because he's the deformed inbred royalty of the Habsburgs. Okay. I should mention that he's crazy and he was villainous, but his deformities in no way made him crazy or villainous. That was just pure breeding. So in that sense, I do apologize. Chad is not here, obviously, but he wanted to give me a culpa for the statements he made about mental illness and his third grade teacher, unfortunately. That's a big mea culpa on Chad's part for that one as well. So we're sorry.
Settle down now, Klaus. It's time for your next lesson.
And on to our main topic. We've got Jen Martin here with us. Jen, how's it going?
Pretty good.
Jen, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and why we have you on the show?
You know, I actually had to ask that question myself until I started talking to some people. And they're like, well, why wouldn't you be on the show, Jen? So I think probably the biggest thing going on is that I've been a part of the group in the Upper Midwest that's been running Gatsby and the Great Race.
Nice.
Awesome. So that's been a lot of fun. We've been doing that about a year and a half, 2 years now. Almost 2 years, I believe.
That has to be a logistical nightmare.
You know, it's funny because Gatsby's my very first experience running a convention game. What?
You are not messing around.
No, not at all.
Your first con game was Gatsby?
Well, I guess technically like 8 years ago, I tried to run a game that was a fantasy game, but it was horrible and it scared me away from running convention games ever again. Actually, from GMing at all ever again.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a bit of a story.
So Gatsby. So, okay, so although I'm like 99% sure that everybody listening to this knows what Gatsby and the Great Race is, why don't you explain that real quick and try and give us an idea of what that is and why we're so impressed that this is your first con game?
With or without spoilers?
Spoiler fire it.
Oh, poor John.
That's okay. John,
have you never done it?
I'm going to play it at Necronomicon.
Oh, with Jen. Maybe with Jen. Maybe we shouldn't spoil it for you.
Maybe light.
Light. Very can we do light spoilers?
All right. Well, okay. So Gatsby and the Great Race is a 1920s setting of Call of Cthulhu. The game is centered around the character Julian Gatsby, who has inherited his father's estate, and it doesn't have much money left. And so he has to find a way to get rich quick. And the whole game starts with, or is centered around, the Traverse Stakes. And oh gosh, right now I don't even remember the year of it. But it was a horse race where the long shot won. And so he finds a way to profit off of that. And in doing so, invites some nefarious creatures into the world.
So explain to us why it's such a logistical nightmare, though, for Gatsby and the Great Race. Because unlike, there's something special about this particular game that's
it is unlike
every other.
So Gatsby and the Great Race is specifically a convention game because it's run at multiple tables. So, and this may be a little spoilerish. The last time we ran it, we ran 5 reality tables. And then there's also the extra dimension, which is kind of a space that characters or players with their characters get moved into throughout the game. So yeah, it can be a logistical nightmare because you have 5 reality tables and then you have an extra dimension and you need a couple of keepers for the extra dimension and then a keeper for every reality table.
And you have players that are going between tables the entire time this is happening.
Absolutely. Right. And what we found is the more tables you have, the fewer players get to move.
Really?
Yeah. Well, you run out of time. And we actually have been running a 6-hour game. We play it to be done within 5 to 5.5 hours because we find that after the game is over, the experience is so amazing that everybody stands around for the next hour or two talking about the game and just going over what was going on at your table. What was that reference there? And just it's really an experience that I'm a little sad I'll never get to experience on the other side of the screen.
So what typically do you do at the table? Are you one of the reality GMs or?
Ever since we started running it, I have always run table 3 every time.
And that's a reality table?
It is. Yeah. I am anxious, though, to get to a extra dimension table. And my understanding is that when we run it at Necronomicon, and I'm not sure how many of our regular group are going to make it to Necronomicon, but my understanding is that the reality keepers may be Paul and Mike. And I'm not sure who the third one might be. I'm not sure how many tables we're even going to run or even what day we'll do it on. But I may get my opportunity to be an extra dimension keeper.
Wow.
And that can be a bit of a logistics. Being a reality keeper is a little easier because you're just running a game. It's a very simple thing. And the only thing that makes it a little more complicated is that you have to find a way to communicate with not the other tables, but with the extra dimension. So we typically use our phones and use an app on our phones for communicating. Being an extra dimension keeper, you need to keep track of every player at every table and where they started and where they're going and where they've been and who is holding what, which character is holding what. And then you have to scare them and terrify them and move them from table to table and keep them off balance. And so I just need to try and kill them or make them go insane by the end of the game.
So the extra dimension table is those are the overall GMs essentially that are kind of running the show.
And kind of. So we usually have one head extra dimension keeper that's keeping all of that straight with others that are doing transporting people back and forth. So what happens is when you're transported to the extra dimension, you're blindfolded. And so you are really disoriented when you get to the extra dimension. And then you're blindfolded again before you leave it to return to what may or may not be the table where you started.
And is that always done? Is the extra dimension table always in a separate room or is it?
Yes, we always make it a separate room. Right. The first time we ran it, we were lucky that we had each table that we ran was in its very own room. More recently, as we've run it, we create this gigantic tent that's covered in moving blankets. And so it's very dark and the sound is very dead inside. And I really have to say, I have to give credit here because I am not the one that makes Gatsby happen. It's Corey that makes Gatsby happen. So I live not far from Corey Welch, who's also a friend of the show.
Yes.
We all love Corey. And Gatsby kind of got started because, well, back a couple of years ago, I had never played Call of Cthulhu in my life, never even heard of Lovecraft, and sat down at one of his games to play. He said, Jen, you should play this. And I'm like, okay, I'll play in one of your games. That sounds like fun. And so I sat down, and I believe that was, I want to say it was 2015, fall of 2015 at GameholeCon, and I played in Moonchild. And Corey was the keeper, and he was a little nervous because he figured I'd sit down and I'd play a woman character, and he was afraid that it was going to be a little too much for me, that I was going to end up being the character giving birth to a demon or something. It turned out I loved the game. And so I played another game that weekend, and then that next spring, he ran The Haunting. Thank you, John.
Yay.
And so
Corey and I had fun beefing that up.
Yeah. So I got to play in that, and that was fun. And I also played with You Two Can Cthulhu that year.
Yeah.
And they have a pretty amazing experience. So they come to GaryCon every year. So I played in their game. And then I think the next convention I saw Corey, we played Legs, which I think is a Skype of Cthulhu scenario.
Yep, from Jim Phillips. Yep.
And that was awesome because it's set in a hotel, and the description of the hotel in the game, in the scenario, is exactly the same description as the hotel we were in at the time.
Nice.
So it was a little creepy. And so then I started telling Corey, my husband is also a gamer, and I started telling Corey about a fantasy game that we had, scenario that we wanted to try, and we wanted to do a multi-table fantasy scenario where what happened at one table affected the other table. He said, well, you know, there's a scenario like that for Call of Cthulhu. And I'm like, yeah, but I've never run Call of Cthulhu, and I don't know. But he convinced me to do it. And a year later, we ran it.
Well, congratulations to other Corey for insisting you do it.
Right, right.
I have to say, if nobody's done this before at a convention game, at some point or another, you need to block off the 8 hours and just get it done. It is an absolute blast.
Oh yeah. This game is amazing. And I have to say, my understanding is at Necronomicon, we're going to get 4 hours, not six. So just kill them faster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The hardest part of the game is the first hour. The first hour can be really tedious because that's the only part of the game that's just a normal Call of Cthulhu game. And you're just trying to fill time because you're playing it in real time. So the first, the game is the first hour of the game, and then you repeat it, and then you repeat it, and then you repeat it. Each time you repeat it, there's other things going on. In the first hour, there's not so much going on. So you're really kind of, you're basically making small talk for an hour as a reality keeper.
But as your players, you're getting deeper into character and exploring the world around you.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. Have you done any other game or convention organization at all?
I have. So the year that Corey said to me, hey, let's play Gatsby next year, I had also at that point committed to joining the staff of Nexus Game Convention in Milwaukee. Or I'm sorry, not Nexus Game, Nexus Game Fair in Milwaukee. And so I kind of bit off a lot that year. Let's run Gatsby and start organizing all of the volunteers for a whole convention. So I helped with Nexus for 2 years. It was 2017 and 2018. I am no longer helping out with Nexus. It is usually the end of May and the beginning of June. And I'm a homeschool mom, and my son is now a kindergartner. And that's when our state conventions tend to be for homeschooling. And now that he's actually of school age, I want to be able to go to those conventions. And if I'm running a convention, I can't do that. So I had to leave Nexus, although we plan on going back. In fact, this past spring, just earlier this month, was my son's first GaryCon. Well, technically a second Gary Kahn. He was there when he was 2 months old. but he actually, we registered him. We got him a badge. He played games. He had a ball. And he just felt so grown up going to Gary Kahn, my grown up 6-year-old.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
So Ethan actually has been playing games probably his whole life. When he was an infant, just born, we would put dice in his hands when our regular gaming group was over at our house and kind of wobble his wrist until he let go of the dice so he could roll for us for good luck. So that was
hilarious.
Yeah, that was the extent of his gaming until he was about 2.5, 3 years old. Once he started being able to talk, we started collaborative storytelling as a family pastime. So my husband would start a story and Ethan would interrupt and say, "Oh, but Daddy," and he'd add a detail. And Daddy would say, "Ethan, it sounds like you know this story. Why don't you tell it for a little while?" And so he would, until I interrupted with a detail. And then Daddy would say, "Mama, it sounds like you know this story too. How about you tell it?" So we would take turns telling the same story.
It sounds like you're like just a couple of rules away from your own Cthulhu Dark.
So that's how we got him into gaming. And then when he was about 3.5, almost 4 years old, we started playing Hero Kids with him, which is a very simple D6 opposed roll system.
Yes, that's a really nice system.
It is. It is. We had to wait until he could count the pips on the dice. And so once he could do that, he could figure out who won the opposed roll. So at about 3.5, he was able to do that. And we were playing with him. And then probably that winter, right after he turned 4, we were playing a game as a family and he decided we had just beat the big bad guy. And he took the markers for the little wet map out of Daddy's hand and said, "Okay, now it's my turn." And he started drawing a little stream on the mat. And then he took a handful of miniatures and he dropped them at the end of the stream. And he said, "Okay, you go." And that was the first time he ran his very own game.
That's hilarious.
And it didn't take very long for him to figure out player agency, verisimilitude, that the game isn't about winning, that it's about having fun, that the GM's job or the keeper's job is to make sure that everybody's having fun. It can go nothing like what you wanted it to go. As long as everybody's having fun, you did it right. And so now at 6 years old, his birthday parties are all gaming parties. We had his birthday party at our local gaming store this past January.
Oh my gosh.
It's a lot of fun having a gaming family.
That is awesome. And are these just recreation that y'all are playing together? Or as a homeschooling mom, do games come in, you know, as part of the curriculum?
Oh my gosh, all the time. And we don't even do it intentionally. But you want to learn your numbers and your colors? Play Uno.
Oh, what? Yeah.
Yeah, no, right? I can do that with mine as well. And that does help immensely.
Oh, yeah, it does. And of course, learning to take turns is a very important skill when you're in preschool.
Learning to lose gracefully is another skill that they pick up fairly quickly as well.
Yeah, not Ethan. He's still struggling with that one.
Some better than others. I've got one daughter who refuses to lose.
Yeah, yeah. But we play a lot of games. He always gets games for birthday and Christmas. And I don't go get those weird games like this is a phonics game. Probably the most obviously schooly game that we have is Pickle Letter. And it's a game where you're matching it, you have like something that's similar to a Scrabble tile and you match the letters and you call out the letter names as you do it. But just playing regular games, you don't even have to be a homeschooler, just playing games teaches your kids about reading. It teaches them about patience. It teaches them about strategy, about taking their turn, about what makes playing games fun. We love playing cooperative games. Because we like to teach him how to work with other people, especially because Ethan's an only child, except when we have foster children in our home.
That is awesome.
So I just started branching out. So Gatsby was really the first Call of Cthulhu game I ever ran at a convention, the first successful game I ever ran at a convention. But before I ran Gatsby, I realized, like a couple of months before, oh my gosh, I've just said that I will help run Gatsby, and I've never run Call of Cthulhu in my life. And so
might be an issue.
Yeah. So we had an online Call of Cthulhu group with Corey and some other people from some of the local conventions. We'd get online and we'd play. And so I said, Corey, can you let me run a game once, please? Just, so that we can, get familiar with it before I try to do this big thing at a convention in front of a bunch of strangers. So I ran a few sessions. I actually grabbed something out of the Gaslight book and ran that.
And that is awesome. Gaslight is one that you don't see being run a lot. So that's awesome.
I know you don't. And it's my favorite era to run games in. I'm looking forward to the new Gaslight book coming out.
Same. I'm waiting for it. It's in the works.
I know. So the one thing I really like about Call of Cthulhu, though, is all of the different eras that you can play in. And I think that really has, it's given me an idea for some convention scenarios. Let's say that. I've gone from barely playing Call of Cthulhu at all, being just introduced to it in just a matter of years, running Gatsby, and now thinking, I have some ideas for some scenarios to write. So,
awesome! And with the Miskatonic repository, you could publish them.
Right. So, and I've got some friends that have experience writing some. So I'm gonna hit up them and ask for some help. Actually, I've already hit up Ed to ask him for some help. So that'll be fun. So I noticed one of your questions was, do you read Lovecraft?
Yes. And any other weird fiction are you reading?
No. I have never read Lovecraft in my life.
Don't feel bad. I haven't read Lovecraft in quite a while. In fact, I've been buried in the Malazan fantasy series for, I'm in book five. I've been dumping them down my brain hole like it's crack or something. It's crazy.
Well, I came to Call of Cthulhu kind of oddly, just kind of picking it up at a convention. And I think that for a lot of people, Call of Cthulhu is fun because of the horror aspect of it. But for me, it's the cultural anthropology of it. I love cultural anthropology. And so being able to play across different settings throughout time is what attracts me. I've always been a big fan of Sherlock Holmes. My favorite author is Caleb Carr, who wrote The Alienist.
Oh, I love that book.
Oh my gosh, you're the only other person on the planet I've ever met that's read that book.
Oh my God, yeah. And the sequel. The sequel,
yes, Angel of Darkness.
Yeah, but yes. The Alienist was fantastic.
Yes.
I loved the TV series. That was amazing. I've
not seen it.
I haven't either, and I almost don't want to.
I know. I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, I read that not long after it came out. Like, it must have been 95.
Right. Yeah, a long time ago. Yeah, and you know what? Way back a third book. He's written a third book now.
Well, you know, he wrote a third book then, but it was nonfiction.
Yes. It was something about military history.
It was The Devil Soldier, and this is a Lovecraftian theme in its own right. Well, maybe it wasn't a Lovecraftian theme. It was about a white... It was kind of like what Shogun, the movie... Not Shogun. That Tom Cruise samurai movie. What?
That's not 13th Warrior, is it?
Long,
no. I thought it was Samurai. I don't know.
Was it Samurai or something like that? It was what that was based off of, essentially. It was a white American who rose up the ranks of Japanese society and was leading armies in Japan or in the time. It was an interesting story. They call them the Devil Soldier. But I bought it. I got it as well just because Carr had written it. I had no idea had never really read nonfiction at all at that time in my life.
He's even written a shorter story that was commissioned by the Arthur Conan Doyle Foundation or family that was about, was it Mary Queen of Scots? And the mystery around the murders that happened in Scotland in that castle.
Oh, we're talking about, it must be about the murder of her husband, Lord Darnley.
Yeah, Darnley. And I think it was the murder. And I remember the name of it. It's called The Italian Secretary.
Oh, David Riccio. Okay. Yeah. So that's my, and this is kind of off the beaten track, and John probably knows because he has to listen to me put up with the listen to this in the off takes. But my thing is late Tudor, early early Stuart English history.
Yep. Yep.
And so the murder of Riccio and the Gowrie conspiracy or the Gowrie House affair, which nobody fucking knows about anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody knows.
Will you be my new best friend?
That and all that. Yeah. And then the murder of Darnley, that kind of stuff, you know, and then James's rule and then going into Charles. That's my ballywick nowadays. That's where I live. It's fantastic. So I'm right there with you. I did not know that he wrote a story about David Riccio. So I have to go find that now.
So, and I live just over the border from Wisconsin where the Bristol Renaissance Fair is.
Yeah.
So, we spend the whole, we can easily spend the whole summer there.
Nice.
Yeah, it is fun. It's gotten very expensive, but it's fun.
Yeah, we have the Texas Renaissance Festival, which is not, it's probably, I guess it's about a 3-hour drive from where I am now.
Okay.
Which is a bit far for me, if I'm honest, but it's it's an absolute blast. I think, John, you've been to that one, haven't you?
Yeah, when I was in high school,
living
in Houston.
It's huge now, though.
Oh, my gosh.
It's a massive affair. It's as big as any of them I've ever seen, you know?
So remember when I was telling you about, I was telling Corey that we had this idea for this game where what happened at one table affected another?
Yeah.
Well, we finally made that happen this past this month at GaryCon. My husband and I actually wrote a scenario for Castles and Crusades, and we played a fantasy game called By Roads High and Low. And so his table that he ran, we sat right next to each other, and he ran a table where the players played a tactical team, and they were going in and they were destroying whatever was happening head on. And my team played the technical team who went in and researched the problem and did the investigation, all in Castles and Crusades, but it was very Call of Cthulhu-esque. And they did all the investigating and they figured out all of the puzzles. And so as they figured out puzzles, they had a homing chicken who was... If I remember correctly, each team had a homing chicken. It was this was my husband's invention. So, Mark, this is totally props to you. It was 3/4 racing chicken, 1/3 homing pigeon, and 1/3. Oh, I don't remember what the other third was. Oh, bloodhound. 1/3 bloodhound. So, racing chicken, homing pigeon, bloodhound.
Oh, my God.
It could move 200 feet per round, unless it was running, and then it could move 800 feet per round.
What?
And that was to make it invincible, so it couldn't be killed.
And that was actually how you were communicating between the groups?
Right. The two groups could communicate with this chicken, and his group actually was sent out on their quest a day before my group was game time.
Let me ask you this, then. Were you forced to communicate via small pieces of paper that were rolled up supposedly on the chicken's leg?
No, it's awesomer than that.
Oh, shut up. It can't be better
than that. So the chickens were named Chufkin and Gufkin. And I can't remember which one's which off the top of my head. But his players had a chicken. You would have to draw in the earth, draw in the dust on the ground, in the sand, and the chicken would circle it 3 times and then fly off. And then when it got to its destination, it would repeat the picture in the ground for the receiver.
My God. Pictionary.
Right? And then my players, because they were the technical team, they were supposed to be the smarty pants, their chicken could write poetry. could copy poetry and write it out in the earth. But it could only copy poetry where every stanza ended in a question.
Are you serious? Y'all really went out on coming up with the most obscure methods of communication known to man.
Right? So here's the funny thing. I had artists at my table. He did not.
Oh my gosh.
He had poets at his, but you did not.
I don't know. They did kind of, you know, bend some poetry rules. I know there's no rules in poetry, but yeah, some of their poems were like, really? Really? That's the question you're going to ask? Am I doing this right?
Oh but, my gosh.
Hey, you know, it made it easy for me as the game master because I could just sit back for a half an hour and watch them try to write a poem.
Right.
Oh, that is so awesome.
Or watch even them funnier, run around trying- like a proverbial chicken with their head cut off when they're trying to decipher someone else's Pictionary clue.
Oh my gosh, it was crazy. The first Pictionary clue they sent to us, we could not figure out what it was. So at the end, we asked them, what is this thing? And they said, well, it's supposed to be the Iron Throne. It looked like a scribble.
Like four random
far too many swords into it.
Right.
So that one, it was really a great game. We advertised it a little obscurely. So each of us put in our own game when we registered our game with the exact same description, except for the last line. And the last line on mine indicated that they were the technical team and the last line on his that they were the tactical team, but didn't tell them that there was another team. So the only way that you would have known that you were playing in a game with another table was if you had read all of the descriptions of all of the games that were available to read and happened to notice that these two had GMs with the same last name and the same description, except for a tiny little bit. And they were at tables that were next to each other.
That's fantastic.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was really an awesome experience. And we plan on running it again. So I'm sorry, everybody. Who's already learned about Chufkin and Gufkin, but at least I didn't tell you about the scenario itself.
Right. You know, no, that is funny. Amazing. That is so amazing.
It sounds like you guys are going to conventions more and more. Where can some of the listeners think to meet up with you at some point in the future? Where are you going to be?
Oh, gosh. So the next convention we plan on going to is GameholeCon, which is in Madison, Wisconsin. And before that, though, is Nexus Game Fair, which we'll go to, which is in Milwaukee. We'll probably only be at Nexus for one day. We plan on going to Game Hall with our son and our foster daughter, who are both six, for the entire weekend in the fall. And then we always go to GaryCon. We haven't missed a GaryCon since we started going. I think it was GaryCon 3 was our first GaryCon, and they just had GaryCon 11 at the beginning of March. So.
And you and I met at GaryCon 9.
That's right. That's right. Yep. Actually, I went all fangirl on John. It was hilarious. So, I think you were there because you were representing
when you were there for Goodman Games?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was there with Goodman Games, and I was running some Age of Cthulhu stuff. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. I had just gotten into Call of Cthulhu at that point. It was really early on for me, and I don't even know if we'd run Gatsby at that point. I don't think so. Maybe we'd run it once or twice. No, we had not run Gatsby at that point. So I was looking at who I was going to play with, what games I was going to play, and I realized that I had forgotten to sign up on the regular sign-up day, and signing up for games at GaryCon is very competitive. So I went kind of digging through going, oh, what am I going to play? What am I going to play? And I was scanning through and I'm like, John Hook. Wait, John Hook? I know that name. Wait a minute. And so I sent a message to Corey. Corey, is John Hook going to be at GaryCon? He's like, oh, yeah. Didn't I tell you? I'm like, no. How come you didn't tell me?
Because Corey's used to seeing us everywhere. Corey's
right.
Freaking everything. So.
Oh, my gosh. Corey and Steve are always everywhere.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, I'm going to sign up for this because it wasn't even like to me, John Hook's a VIP
Oh, well.
At a gaming convention. But they didn't have him under VIP because you can only have so many VIP games that you play in. So I'm like, dude, I'm signing up for as many of John's games as I can. So I got into one. we were playing DCC. And anybody who plays DCC at GaryCon knows that the Brinkmans, who also have their own podcast, are big DCC GMs. They are Mr. and Mrs. DCC when it comes to DCC couples.
Yeah.
So Jen and I have known each other for some time. I've actually played in a game with Bob every year for the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, Sunday morning Doctor Who at GaryCon. And he's always played the same character, and I've always played the same character, and our characters hate each other.
Ah, that's awesome.
It's great. It's great. And just this year, Bob's like, oh, Nick, you have to put in it one of these years that we find out that Bob's character is an ancestor of Jen's character. Jen, not his wife, Jen.
Right.
So, okay, that was a little tangent there. Sorry. So, it turned out that Jen Brinkman was also playing in John's game. And
that's right. I'm like, yeah.
Holy cow. And Jen said, she grabbed me. She said, Jen, will you save a seat for me? And so I showed up at John's game giddy because I'm like, oh my gosh, Jen Brinkman thinks I'm her friend. She calls me her friend. This is awesome. Right. So thanks. Jen called me her friend. So I'm like, okay, I'm saving a seat for Jen Brinkman. And then I'm like, and I'm playing a game with John Hook and sitting next to Jen Brinkman. And I had no idea what I was doing. I had play tested DCC back at GaryCon 3 or GaryCon 4 when they were first coming out with it. But I hadn't played it since then. I had no idea what I was doing. And I didn't care. I didn't so much pay attention to that game as I just basked in the glory of the game I was playing.
Oh, that's funny.
And so then John, we took a break partway through the game. And he says to me, so Jen, what are you doing after this game? And then immediately says, well, wait a minute here. Let me explain myself a little better. He said, so I'm writing these scenarios for one player and one keeper. And would you please play test it for me? So I said, sure. So then when the game was over, he said, all right, well, the scenario is back in my room. And wait a minute. I don't need you to come to my room.
I'm sorry. I'm back like in that. My room.
I have to go get it. How about we meet somewhere? So we set up a place to meet, and I got to play test a scenario. And so that was great. So that was a pretty highlight GaryCon. I'll remember that GaryCon for a while.
Oh, I'm glad it was memorable. I had a fantastic time, and you were an amazing player.
Oh my gosh. It was so much fun. And I love playing these investigative games. And I love that I was able to take a fantasy game that I've been a fan of for a long time and make that into an investigation game. I mean, yeah, I threw some monsters at them to play, but gosh, I think that they were in combat for all of 40 minutes out of the whole 4 hours when we ran our two table game at GaryCon this past spring. It was awesome. Oh,
that's awesome. That is fantastic.
Thank you, John. You recorded the Traverse Stakes radio script that I had written probably about a year ago for us at GaryCon. And so you had hinted that anybody who played in Gatsby and the Great Race at GaryCon might find a special guest at their gaming table. So I did. I the Reality Keepers were given the option to play your recording, and I did, and it was awesome. And I told my players who the voice was, and some of them knew who it was and were pretty geeked out by that. So thank you very much.
Awesome. I had a blast doing that. That was so fun.
I had so much fun writing that script. It took me about 2 hours because I didn't know anything about calling horse races. I had to educate myself on all the phrases and things that you needed to be able to get around a race course.
I had no idea. I assumed that script, because I've never, played Gatsby and the Great Race. I've never read Gatsby and the Great Race. I assumed that script was just pulled from the, as like box text or something, pulled straight from the scenario. I had no idea that you wrote that. It was amazing.
Wow. Well, thank you. Yeah, it was fun to write. And, I loved we actually, when we were having our keeper meeting beforehand, we were like, well, what can we do? We do this every time that we run Gatsby and we have our keeper meetings, we always sit down and we say, well, what can we do to make the game better? What can we do to improve the experience? And I'm like, you know, it'd be cool if we had a recording of that Traverse Stakes script I put out last year. And they're like, well, who can we have do that? And we're like, well, I don't want to do it. Do you want to do it? No, I don't want to do it. Why don't we get somebody else to do it for us? Why don't we get John to do it? Thank you for saying yes.
Yes, it will. And it was Forrester Gary reached out to me. So,
yeah,
that was awesome. Well, Jen, thank you so much for coming on tonight. We had I had a great time talking with you, and you've had just a crash course in Call of Cthulhu. I can't imagine anyone else doing Gatsby and the Great Race in under 2 years of getting into the game. That's amazing. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
And we want to hear from our listeners, and we have lots of ways you can reach out to us. For a complete list, check out our show notes. That's where you find our email address, which is mup.feedback@gmail.com, as well as the phone number, SpeakPipe link, forums, and our new Discord server.
That's right. Send us your questions, feedback, and topic ideas, or join a discussion. Record a line or tell us who you are, and give us a hearty Go Pods for our home team, the Fightin' Cephalopods.
Find all the links you need to keep in touch at mu-podcast.com/170.
Thank you for joining us for another episode. Class is dismissed.
The Call of Cthulhu role-playing game is property of Chaosium, Inc. The written works of H.P. Lovecraft are held in the United States public domain. All other works mentioned in this podcast are the property of their respective owners. Original content of this show is copyright of the Miskatonic University Podcast under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license.